So it's hanging out, sit comfortably for those that are new, during a bit of talking, and then we'll discuss together as well. I'm going to talk a little bit about thoughts, those thoughts that keep happening in your head, or wherever they happen. And weave it a little bit. I have a few different sort of things that in my kind of psyche are all the same point that might sound really different. I want to start off by saying a tiny something about karma, and then two particular words that are charged and I think useful right now in our culture. And so the basic concept of karma, the word means action, and in a lot of subtlety, in many different kinds of action, aspects of action, in both the Buddhist and Hindu systems. And from an early Buddhist perspective, the teachings on karma are a description of how our experience, moment to moment, our experience in any situation, is conditioned by the past, by things that happened to us or around us or in our field, in the world, and by our own actions in the past that color our experience particularly, right? Lots of people have been mean over the last 46 years in the world, but the one that I really feel the effects of most closely are myself being mean, my own past actions being mean, and then people who are mean directly to me, like ways that I was hurt. So the external conditions goes from the vast, the vastest you can imagine, like oh look, at some point, a gazillion eons ago, the earth was created, and at some point relatively recently on that scale, humans appeared, et cetera, et cetera. From that scope, there's a set of conditions that gives rise to us being here, right? The evolution of these kinds of animal bodies, this kind of discourse, language use, ideas, religions, etc. And then all the way down to the very intimate, I'm here because my family was a certain way, or because my body was a certain kind of body, and all the layers there, because I got my heart broken at just the right time at this age, or wrong time, whatever. So the past conditions piece goes from vast to micro, including the very micro, like my experience in this moment is colored by being a week and a half into that nasty cold thing that everyone is getting. And so I'm still coughing a bit. So, my experience of some slight sensation unpleasantness is conditioned by that. So you know what I mean. And then there's my own actions, right? My relative comfort in this moment is conditioned by having put a cough drop in a few dozen minutes ago. But then it's maybe more deeply conditioned by, whatever else, the fact that my kid was really cute this afternoon, or that, my marriage has survived the first year of having a baby, whatever. There's and things I did that made that happen are also the conditions here. So this is the basics of karma. Everything has a result, yeah? So with that as a basis, I'm going to propose that these two words, one is trauma, and the other is privilege. And that these two words essentially describe two poles of previous conditions, the conditions that have led to this moment. So one is any kind of situation where what's still happening, conditioned by that, is painful, even subtly. And then the whole web of things that happened that condition the aspects of this moment that are pleasurable. And saying it that way, I kind of want to blow open the definition of both of those words. Often we think trauma means, the particular really bad things that happened to a person or a group of people. And we think about the intense stuff. You were really hurt in this way. I want to open it to all of the conditions that are part of our experience in the present that is on the unpleasant or painful side. So, you know, from the big systemic, like, you know, oh, look, systemic racism and misogyny still exists. You know, terrible, right? We can feel it. It's here now. To the extent that it's gives rise to that something which is painful, we'll call it trauma. No matter the intensity of how it affected any particular person, we can say in its more intense effects, it's a very, very serious issue. In its subtlety, it's almost serious in a different way, that it's pervasive in the culture, which makes it very difficult to uproot deep traumas like this. Other things are, you know, little personal things that we often wouldn't call trauma, you know, like I was mean to a kid in eighth grade. It's true. You know, we all got over it. It was part of being 12 or whatever you are. But the fact that I can remember it and see his face and feel not just a wholesome regret, but really feel a kind of ache or a weight or a wrenching in my system, we could put it on that side of the equation. Oh, it happened, it's still painful. The privilege side, often we use privilege more somewhat narrowly, like, you know, folks who are part of dominant groups in our culture have privilege, and folks who are part of oppressed groups don't. And that's a good usage of that, because it really points at things that to some folks are largely unconscious, to the folks with privilege largely, are unconscious, right? And the beautiful definition of privilege, which is, if I add the Buddhist word conditions to it, conditions that led to me receiving benefits that I did not personally earn, right? So I have the benefit in being a kind of middle class, white-ish, well-educated, cisgendered male in this culture that people listen to me when I say stuff. And if I'm unconscious that that's true or in denial that that's true, then the suffering from that kind of privilege is more intense. If I become aware of it, in a certain way it's more painful because I see it happening all the time. And then also I have some chance of addressing it, right, if I'm aware of it. So that's sort of the standard kind of political way that we're using privilege right now, appropriately. But again, what if we broaden it to mean everything that ever happened whose results are now favorable? You know, like what if the way that my mom in the 70s wouldn't let us have sugar at all for like 10 years, if that had some result, and it played out however it did. In whatever, like, and it's complex, right? Did it turn me into more of a punk as a teenager who bought ice cream sandwiches with my lunch money? Mm-hmm. Probably, right? Does it have an effect in the health of my body that I can't even quantify because this is just the body that I have? But if it had been different, if I'd been in a different social class or a different culture or a different hippie mom, it would be different. So all I can say is, oh, that's a subtle condition. It's one of an infinite number of subtle conditions which perhaps has a positive resonance now. It contributes to my experience in the present moment being more pleasant. So then what we have is a huge spectrum of past conditions that many of which caused our present experience to be painful, and we can just call all of that sort of the trauma side of the spectrum, whether it's profoundly mild or profoundly intense. And then a whole spectrum of things that were conditions leading to well-being in this moment, which we can call the privilege side of the spectrum. So privilege is the opposite of trauma. And I think part of what's beautiful about seeing this, what's beautiful to me about seeing it this way is that, this is part of what I want to say about thought, is that when I focus on the conditions part of karma, it's quite impersonal, right? Even these subtle conditions of like, my mom didn't give me sugar, but I memorized every episode of the Brady Bunch. Like condition, it's a condition. What did it lead to? You know, I don't know, something. When I look at it this way, it's clear that all of those impulses from the past are not from myself. And I can then look at what's tormenting me in the moment when I'm anxious or worried or afraid or angry or confused. And the way the mind spins, so much of what happens in meditation or all the time, is that our mind, and that's a little bit shorthand for the entire inner world of thoughts and feelings and subtle intuition and long, annoying lectures and things that happen inside, some quotation marks. The mind spins these thoughts, and thoughts give rise to feelings. Other things also give rise to feelings, but thoughts very much do. And part of what we're asked to do, especially in the Buddhist, in the mindfulness side of the Buddhist tradition, is to really understand very deeply what is actually happening moment to moment. Say, oh, the mind is spinning a story, and the story is called, I'm not good enough, or the story is called, the world is falling apart, or the story is called, one of those is more true than the other, when you have it. But they're both ultimately narratives. They're both ultimately this thing that we do where we make a story out of our life. And then it has its comic moments, its tragic moments. But you're the star, you know, no doubt, of the story. It's all about you. And we want to ask, like, where do those come from? In the yoga tradition, in the teachings of the Yoga Sutra by a mysterious sage named Patanjali, it's not quite clear historically who that was, there's a definition of yoga that says yoga is to still or settle or bring to cessation the patterns or habits of the mind or of consciousness. And one way we can think about that is, oh, this thing the mind does, it spins, it tells stories all the time. What is that actually? They're so repetitive, right? The underlying plot points are endlessly repeated, right? I'm great. Oh my God, I suck. They like me. They don't like me. You know, it's like I'm safe. The house is good. I can afford it. I'm growing the garden. Oh my God, I might get evicted. I have to move. Something is changing. It's a fairly predictable scene, and it oscillates. Where does this come from? What are these thoughts? I think too often in meditation instructions, we're given the instruction just to, in a sense, treat thoughts as if there's some random stuff that happens, and just kind of ignore them and come back to the breath, or let them play out, but don't give them much mind. And I think this has its strengths as an instruction, but it's not the whole picture. And part of the whole picture is that the thoughts and feelings, the obsessions, I'm talking about anxiety mostly here, like the way that the mind spins with negativity. I would also talk about like kind of prideful narcissism. If I knew very many of those people, we might have just elected one. There's still a hope. And it's amazing actually how one of the most current hopes for what might happen in the Electoral College, the Hamilton electors, is tied to the most fabulous Broadway musical that's happening right now, right? And then I just saw one of the great sages of my political world, Rebecca Solnit, who was speaking to some media, and she said like wearing her Hamilton outfit, she was wearing this great like kind of brocade coat, long coat, and a poofy thing, and she's got this like white hair tied back. She looks, I just wanted to play the role, right? She looks a little bit 18th century when she wants to. So I'm like, how did we pull that off? That like the Broadway show is cross-branded with the Electoral College disaster right now. That's totally an aside. But for a few of you, that's funny. A funny aside. So much of what happens in the mind is our mind telling ourselves the story of ourselves. Right, what's happening in my relationships, and and what I want to see is those stories come from somewhere. And mostly they don't come from what I would call myself. Right? Partly because all of the ones that are in language form, that are actually words that I tell myself, are embedded in like my presence within a language. Right? I'm fluent in English, I think in English. And so there are concepts that are foreign to English that I don't think. Right? I can only think in English concepts that English understands. This is one of the kind of secret mysteries of language, is you can't actually think about something that the language isn't equipped to describe. It's one of the reasons that in the mystical texts, in the Buddhist world for sure, in the Hindu world for sure, there's a point in the teachings where texts start to say things like, honestly, it can't be described, so don't try. And they say things like, well, what we can say is what it's not, right? Well, it's not peacefulness, because that would just be the opposite of non-peacefulness, but it's not peacefulness. Well, it's peaceful. They're trying to describe like liberation or the state of enlightenment, of freedom. And they're like, well, it's not that you leave the body, but it's not that you're stuck to the body either. It's not that you no longer exist, but it's actually not quite that you exist anymore either. And this is not just like mystics having fun at 3 a.m., you know, on a lot of cacao, although there's that. Certainly for the Buddhist mystics, it wasn't cacao, but... but it could have been something else. Soma is the old Hindu word. So it's not just that, although there's aspects of that. Sometimes you read the text and you're like, you're just having fun with this. Especially some of the Zen texts that are just beautiful in that regard. You know. But it's actually, at times, the most reasonable way to describe something that's very difficult to describe. So then, first of all, we're thinking within a language and then a concept language. Like, I can't think concepts that my culture didn't teach me. Every once in a while, I get a hit of one, like, and we call them insights, right? When you think or feel something that you weren't really trained overtly to think or feel, often these, like, turn our lives around. You get an insight into something, you're like, oh, nobody taught me that. Or they taught it in a way that I didn't get, but now I get it, right? And these are quite rare. So we can say having an original thought is quite rare. And powerful when they happen. They really turn the boat. In a certain way, the liberation traditions, the yogic traditions, are all about creating the conditions for us to have an original feeling, an original thought. What do you have to do to have the thought, oh my God, these thoughts are not me. And to really get it, to have it like hit you, that this whole story you've been telling about how awesome or terrible you are, in alternation, of course, or what things mean, that story is conditioned, that it's based on your culture, it's based on your language, it's based on your family, it's based on all of the past factors, traumatic and privileged, that have led to you being here. We can't view the world outside of the lens of what we inherited. Right? It's part of why, I know I'm weaving, this. I told you this is a lot of little threads. It's part of why I think one of the big issues in our current, say, political scene, in the election scene, is empathy. Part of what's being talked about is how important it is for folks to learn to empathize with folks whose views are very different, and then the problems with not even knowing those folks exist, you know, being so contained in your bubble of, like, everyone I know is a radical sex-positive communist. And being like, well, there are other people, you know, around. And they're not even just in Kentucky where my in-laws are. They're actually just, like, across Oakland, but I never see them, you know. If they would come to, you know,
Pizzaiolo.
But they don't. Right? If I would go to their place, then I would see them. So empathy actually is this remarkable quality. Some people, we think it's ordinary. There's actually a whole academic argument right now about whether it even exists. Whether empathy actually exists even as a real emotion. Or if the thing we call empathy is actually kind of layers of almost like projection and like transference and countertransference and denial and aspects of like how we figure out how to have an identity in the world. Empathy is the core of the Tibetan Buddhist system. It's embedded in the early system and it really flowers in the later Buddhist systems. I think because one of the things that is so not instinctive to a certain aspect of our thinking, kind of self-protective physiology, is to make an attempt to think an original thought, to think outside of what I already know, to, in a sense, what empathy says is, imagine what it feels like to have other conditions than your own, right? Imagine what it feels like to have someone else's trauma conditions or someone else's privilege conditions rather than your own. And in a certain way, what it says is, imagine different thoughts, imagine different stories, imagine a whole different worldview than what you know. And it's very hard to do. It gets a lot of, like, there's a lot of workshops right now around kind of difference and learning to do this. You have to want to, first of all, to do it. For some folks, it comes very naturally also. But it's, I think it's on the same level as what an insight is. That what it is, in the course of practice, that I've set up the conditions to, another way of saying it would be, snap out of the trance of my own conditions. That, like, especially if my conditions have been fairly consistent, you know, like, if I'm the kind of privileged person where no one ever tells me I'm wrong, you know, that gets me into a certain sort of dangerous feedback loop, right? It's very hard to snap out of those conditions and be like, oh, not only could I be wrong, but I have the conditions of no one ever telling me that, but there are some people who, whether they're right or wrong, people are always telling them that they're wrong, and that those conditions would give rise to a feeling or a state that's radically different from my own. And it's very difficult to feel across a strong, kind of a deep gulf like that. So that's part of our practice, is to do so. The end last week, there was a question. I mentioned judgment in the kind of discussion period, and someone said, someone who was there at the group for the first time, who's not here today, said, you know, as if it's a simple question. Okay, well, you know, what do we do with, like, the judging mind? What do you do with the mind that judges? That's like, the I suck, or other people suck, or, you know. And praise is the same as negative. Praise is the same as blame, right? You know this. To say I'm awesome is the same error in terms of cognitively than saying I suck. We like it better, so we don't pay as much attention to it. It's grasping just the same. It's probably slightly less dangerous, but only slightly, practice-wise. What do you do about the judge? So judgmental thoughts, as an example, this will sort of close the, this part of it, and we'll chat together. Judgmental thoughts, as an example, we can say, are a pattern of thought and feeling, right? So, and that's habitual. It wouldn't be an issue if it almost never happened, but it happens over and over and over, and in a very repetitive way often. Whether your pattern is to judge yourself or to judge others, and they usually come together quite a bit. And in some way we could say, oh, if I feel into what's happening when there's judgment present, usually I'm either complaining about there being something uncomfortable in the moment that I'm not ready to face, so I blame somebody for it, you know. Myself often, you know. Or if it's praise, the Buddhist suggestion would be, I'm not ready to embrace the reality that the success I just had is completely fleeting and transient. So I praise myself in order to kind of hold on a little bit to the good feeling that I just had by doing something well, or etc. So both praise and blame, or judging thoughts, both pleasant and unpleasant, or judging thoughts responding to pleasure and displeasure, comfort and discomfort, success and failure, are in a way this habit that arises in relation to this privileged trauma spectrum. Stuff happens in the past, it's pleasant or unpleasant. Part of how that conditions the present is I try to figure it out. I try to explain to myself what happened and why. And part of that is, well, it went poorly because I suck. It went well because I'm awesome. Or it went well because I got lucky, but I still suck. Right? That's a good one. It went poorly because other people suck, but I'm basically great. Right? That's the other side. So, right? That's our menu. It's a bitter menu. It's a bitter tasting menu. This is one of the kinds of thought that the yogic teachings, the Buddhist teachings, fiercely suggest that we deal with. They really are strong in saying, this is not useful. Neither side of it is useful. And so, what do we do about it? Because it's in some ways some of the most suffering, ongoing suffering, internally, comes from this. And again, this is a talk really about, again, the internal thoughts and feelings. This isn't about systemic conditions, which is a different but related task, how to deal with the actual present conditions and how what we do now does condition the future for ourselves and others. This is really, what can I do in the moment to condition a better internal future, even moment to moment? And the answer I gave was essentially three things. First, we have to notice it. I have to notice patterns of thought. The habit with them is not to notice them. They just happen, and they, partly because they're so repetitive, we just take them as truth. I have a client who has a story about themselves that they repeat many, many times. And the story is essentially the foundation for any particular narrative that's happening. It's like, well, this thing happened this week because I'm this way. You know, well, I'm this way, so it's going to happen this way. And it's very difficult as a teacher to jump in and say, do you notice that that's a story that you keep saying over and over, that you are this way? And every once in a while I'll say that just sort of to see what happens, to see where we've got to in the process. And often the response is some variation of, well, it's true, and then the story goes on, mm-hmm. right? And we do this so much, right, in ourselves. And even though you might come to satsang or come to read, you know, a text, and the text says, you know, don't believe that thought. It's a story. It's a narrative. Yeah. one comes, you know, I'm like this, and because I'm like this, the situation is happening like this. And it's almost like we're like, okay, okay, I understand that I'm not supposed to believe it, but this one is true. You know? So like, I'm gonna technically not believe it, but actually it's true, so I'm going with it. I'm sticking with it. Yeah. And there's a kind of bravery that leans into a very interesting state. What we're actually suggested to do is to disbelieve, and this leans into the next sort of thing, which is disidentify with these stories, even if we think they're true. And this takes, just to say, often a marvelous amount of effort, of will, because it sounds so true, and it explains the world for me. And what we want to notice is that that explanation decreases suffering. It actually makes me feel better to say, I suck. Because if I really do suck, then the bad things that happen are, like, natural, you know? And the good things that happen, I can't get attached to because they may never happen again. There's just good luck. In both of those cases, I don't have to take responsibility, right? Because the story says, I'm just this way. It takes an incredible maneuver that our practice of focus and stillness is partly prepares us for, to say, okay, I notice this thought, so noticing is the first step, and I know what it is, like, oh, this is judging. Naming it is huge. Oh, this is judging. Right? You might even name, you know, like, ah, this is thinking that I'm this way or that way, and yes, there's also the feeling of, like, I think it's true. So you can notice all that stuff. From there, we're really working on states of mind and body. From there, the instruction is, feel it. Actually feel what's underneath that thing. And be like, oh, haha, I'm afraid. You're like, okay, good. So go from like just noticing it, it's a thought pattern, and then hang out with it and your body long enough to be like, okay, this thing where I always say that I'm such and such, what's right under the surface? What's under the words of that? And be like, oh, I feel shy, or I feel, you know, embarrassed, or I feel afraid. Hanging out with that feeling for a little while, it will settle because they do. Or it'll get worse and you'll get freaked out. But, you know, eventually it will land. Whether it lands easily or not depends on where you are on the trauma privilege spectrum. It's a privilege to have emotional states land smoothly on their landing gear. And the third step, and this is the hard one, as if those other two aren't hard. The third one is to really insist on seeing it as not myself. To really say, oh, that's from my family. Oh, that's from my culture. Or even just like, oh, that's judging. Like, period. The web of what, and the reason for this, right, is again, back to the beginning, the last piece, right, is that what led to this moment is not just my own actions. It's a tiny piece. The tip of the iceberg. The whole rest of the iceberg is past conditions, and they're vast. Vast. The Buddhist tradition often, many of the early liberation traditions emphasize the personal action piece much more. I think particularly because it's the one you can actually do something about. So, you know, I can work on my own racism. I can't destroy single-handedly systemic racism in the world. So then the text says, oh, well, work on your own peace. You know, that's the place where you can really be active. And from there, do more. You know, do what you can. Join with others who are also doing their own peace. But the third step with any difficult thought, and judging is a huge example, is to not identify with it. is to say, I say it as if it's easy, to be like, and I use the phrase, oh, look. That's my disidentification phrase. I say, oh, look. You know, the narcissist has arrived. Oh, look, the scaredy cat has arrived. Oh, look, the one who thinks I suck has arrived. And you just, you check it out, you watch it, the thoughts play through, there's feelings, it's usually kind of yucky. Mm. As they pass, and your state changes, because again, thoughts are state-specific. We'll talk more about that another time. But state is the underlying thing that's happening. If your body's not afraid, you're not going to have fearful thoughts. Body comes first. Right? Or at least, body and thought are both metaphors. And given that, it's metaphorically useful to say body comes first. It's useful in a practice way to say body comes first. They probably are versions of the same thing. Tune into the body, notice your state shift, and when your state has shifted, notice that the mind pattern has also shifted. So, working with judging, deep patterns of thought, first notice, recognize, track, feel, move it through, or allow it to move through. And then don't think it's you. Don't think it's you. So, it's good for now. Thank you. Take just a moment to let it land and see how it resonates and bumps around in you. Feelings. It's just on 9. You said you had to duck out. So, and you right at 9. Okay. Yeah. Thoughts and feelings, Stephanie.
It's interesting that you talked about this particular thing because I just had kind of a big insight, if you will, around this very topic last week. Mm. I really started noticing my own thought patterns about like wanting kind of a lot of praise, but never feeling fulfilled by it. Like as soon as I got it, it's like I was grasping for more, and just like how painful that really was. Yeah. But it's interesting because I came kind of
nice
to
noticing.
Yeah, truly. It was kind of a crazy one. It was a doozy, but I was glad I went through it. But, like, it's interesting because I went through a different process to kind of disidentify, but I did ultimately end up disidentifying. So I was at a metta retreat or loving kindness, for those of you who don't know the practice. And so I was wishing myself, you know, well, and wishing myself for liberation and, you know, all these things all day. Mm-hmm. And then I would notice times when I was, like, grasping for that kind of praise from, like, the teachers or whatever, like, constantly. And so then I would like feel that and I'd be like, this is awful, this feels very painful, and here I am wishing myself well all day and wishing liberation for myself, and just like that discordance kind of led me to a place of just kind of equanimity and like and being able to just like let it go and not grasp for it and not put myself down for feeling it or anything, you know, just kind of like letting it pass through.
What do you think helped you do that?
I mean, I guess just like putting so much energy into bringing like a benevolent feeling to myself and to others and everything, like just all that energy and then feeling the force, that other force just so strongly, like when that came with the grasping.
Yeah.
That is just like, this is exhausting. Like,
truly.
Yeah. And the kind of metta practice, like, before I, like, had done this retreat, I had practiced it, but I always thought of it as kind of self-indulgent when you bring it to yourself. Mm-hmm. But I just really realized through that experience that it actually like has a quantumist quality that like enables you to like come to these points of disidentification with like you know things that might be you might be stuck in patterns and loops because it's so different from what we normally do.
Talk about like having a new thought or feeling, like to spend a week. One version of this metta practice is to use these phrases: may I be safe from harm, may I be happy, may I be strong in body and mind, may I live with ease, and to repeat those four phrases or variations of them without stopping from the moment you wake up to the moment you go to sleep. And as you repeat them, trying to feel the kind wish embedded in them. And you know, there ain't nothing like telling yourself a kind wish over and over to shine a light, to really show how not that this other kind of force is, right? And it's a beautiful way to see that it's not you, partly because your intention on retreat is never to emphasize that force, right? What your intention is to stay with the practice.
Yeah.
And so it really shows you, like, where is that coming from?
Yeah.
You know, my, like, the cellar door blew open and some stank, you know, blew up from the basement. And this is exactly how the practice works, right? And so we can say, oh, you were wishing yourself liberation. You succeeded. Like, it worked. This thing that was binding you showed up. And it showed its true nature enough, and you had enough of your own power, your centeredness, to see it, that that your relationship to it actually shifted in the direction of liberation, right, from it.
I mostly wanted to share that just because it's like, I had heard kind of the process that you described before, and it helped me in a lot of ways with other things, but I feel like having the metta, like approaching it this way, brought it something else to light that led to ultimately the same ending. You know,
definitely.
The disidentification. But definitely, like the process you mentioned also like has worked for me in the past with other things, but like with this particular thing loop I was caught in, it like brought it to light.
Beautiful. Beautiful. Awesome. Other thoughts? Here or questions about practice in general?
I can share. You described what I've been going through the past few months, but actually probably longer than that, years. I've been not only like judging myself, but hearing other people's judgments as my own inner voice.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of those judgments come from the dominant thinking in the culture. And it's related to being single and being there, having to be a reason why.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, it's so, it's like embedded in movies and in, you know, everywhere in the culture. And recently, I've decided to, you know, I'm like close to 40, and I just decided that, you know, I want to have a baby and I'm going to adopt. And making like this announcement to my family, because it's not accepted so much culturally, was huge, and I received a lot of judgment for it. And a lot of blame and a lot of shame for not having succeeded.
Mm-hmm.
Which has been deeply painful to have that piled on into my own judgment.
Yeah, truly.
Sorry, I didn't expect to get emotional, but I realized that I've had to speak out, not just to my family and friends and people in my community, but in this process, you know, I was just kind of surprised that the adoption coordinator, who's a social worker, was scrutinizing and like trying to figure out why, you know, just like trying to learn about me and my relationship history, but also posing the same questions, like, do you think you were too picky, or do you think, and all of this blame, and I was like thrown off, like not expecting it to come from someone who should be sensitive and should have worked with, you know, single people in this process.
Yeah.
And I just had this insight, like, you know, that's an unfair question. It's wrong of you to ask that, because it's like asking someone who has cancer, why do you think you have cancer? Or, you know, someone who has something that's not, has something happened to them that's not within their control.
Yeah.
And she was like, oh, I never thought of it that way. And I said, yes, because that's not the way our culture teaches us to think about it.
Yeah.
And,
good going.
Yeah, it felt like, it felt great to just, to be educating her, you know, because it's going to help her help other people. But I felt like, you know, just, it's because of all the practice that I've done that I've been able to be strong in understanding, what are stories, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. And what's the truth? And, yeah, so anyway, just thought I'd share that. It's hard for me to talk about.
Yeah, thank you for even for trying to. It's moving, I'm sure. If you hear it, that it is. What you're describing, I, you know, you say like part of the result of your practice, you know, part of it is that you have the strength and wisdom interwoven to not be lost in the version of that story that is most commonly kind of taught, which is, you know, that it's your fault somehow, and that you, you know, take that story on, right, in a kind of internalization of that oppression, right? But that you can see that, and your practice gives you some distance from the intensity of, it's not distance from the intensity of feeling, but some frame for holding the intensity of your feeling around it, that you can see, like, oh, this is culture, and this is, you know, this is my family's, and this is where it's come from, this is media. And, yeah, and that really is a benefit of, it's a benefit of practice, certainly, and I imagine it's a benefit, it's a result of other favorable conditions, you know, that you've been able to learn and practice and grow. I was adopted myself at birth, so I have a warm spot for folks who would do that. Something, maybe one more piece that is that's true in many situations where someone being oppressed is you know, confronts or teaches their an unconscious oppressor, is also just to say that that it shouldn't be a responsibility to do so, right? But it's a blessing, it's a privilege for her to have been able to learn it from someone as gracious as you. Yeah. Anything else?
Well, just that I had this really lovely experience this weekend of around all of the creativity that comes from, like, the thought of having a new thought, you know, and I think I've been really excited about the thought of, like, escaping from language, you know, and so I went to this thing where it was very regimented, no speaking for these, like, 3 hours, as underscore, it was the dance.
You know? Oh, beautiful.
And, there was, like, a disassociation, and there was, like, a story, but the story didn't have any words, and so it was, like, a new story, and I didn't quite know what it was, And so that was really exciting.
That sounds so sweet.
Yeah.
Nice. So, yeah, sometimes I think like, oh, I want to think about something. Can I think about it only in pictures? Like, can I think about it not in words? Mm-hmm. And I think some people actually just do this quite naturally, and I don't. So it's interesting for me to think about. You know, I think when I was an early teenager, someone said, you do realize that before language was invented, we were thinking about things. We were roaming around the natural world, doing stuff and figuring things out and you know, being analytical and relational and communicative without words. And that sort of just blew my mind. I was like 13 or something. My dad probably said it. Our conversations were all, you know, astrophysics and cosmic geologic time and whatever. And I was like, oh, what would that be like, right? To be kind of pre-discourse in a certain way. Anything other thoughts, Monica? Good to see you.
Good to see you. I feel like I'm not sure what I'm about to say, but I'm pregnant and I'm not married. So.
Blessings, dear.
Yeah, thank you. I actually am in a parasocial relationship, so I don't know why I'm crying. I cry a lot.
You're pregnant.
I cry.
No, we cry a lot.
I love crying. But I find, and my mind keeps going to this bit that you said about how there's a discussion around whether or not empathy is even, like it even exists, or if it's just this layer of other things, you know, which I think is really interesting. I'm probably going to lay in bed and think about it more because I feel like or just read about it on the internet or something, but say that it's not a thing because it's a layering of other things would be to say that other things are solely their own, and so that whole concept, I'm like, what could they be talking about?
Yeah.
But
just to say that that whole conversation exists pretty much only in a layer of like deep critical theory, and no one else cares about that. Empathy is real, everyone knows it, except a few hyper postmodern theorists. Okay. So looking at philosophy in a certain, just to say.
Okay. I won't lose sleep.
Yeah.
I find that I think at another satsang I've been to, I've talked about how sometimes I feel like empathy is like my Achilles heel, because I'll just like cry for other people. Mm-hmm. And in this whole election, it's just been very interesting because I am from a family that mostly voted for someone I just like cannot find any respect for. And here I am headed to home for Christmas, and I am pregnant with a little brown baby. And I think it's funny because this privilege of being a white cisgender female from a town that like I was like a, you know, an athletic star and did a lot of things that people thought were good, you know, growing up, and probably didn't get told I was wrong very much. And then coming back to it now with this profound sense of empathy that I think I've always had, but definitely changes and feels just like thicker with experience. I'm going to return to this place with my partner. I just don't know what to expect because I empathize with the people in my community and my family who voted the way they did, but it's also quite scary.
It is.
Like, I don't know how it's going to go.
Yeah. So this is true and wise. You don't know how it's going to go.
Yeah.
Right. What you know is that how it's going to go is conditioned by past conditions, both favorable and unfavorable, and the choices of the individuals that are there, including you and your partner.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a way that this teaching on karma is in a certain way meant to be not comforting, but orienting.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's a way of saying, and you know this, you say this, like you can empathize. This is part of what empathy does, is it goes, oh, all those votes for this guy, that happened for a reason. And we know some of those reasons. You know, you can see it in how things have progressed over the last, choose any length of time, last year, the last 10 years, the last 50 years, the last millennium. So there's some way that you can say, oh, the folks here are affected by layers of trauma and privilege, right? Past stuff that was painful and past stuff that was great that's influencing what's happening now. And that even their choice in voting was a conditioned choice, as yours was as well, right? Mm-hmm. This is actually supposed to make us feel better. Right?
Yeah.
Because it takes praise and blame out of the equation. Mostly.
Yeah.
Right? We have some responsibility, and this is a different conversation about whether sort of morality is intrinsic to the universe or relative to cultures or beings, but we do have this choice of how to act moment to moment. And we could say that that choice implies some responsibility to care for ourselves and others.
Mm-hmm.
But if we do the practice of trying to see clearly what's happening in this moment, we can see that so much of it is bigger than exactly what's here. And then, you know, you're like, here I am with my partner, my baby, and the world is the way it is right now, and we're family, and hi. You know? And then it proceeds however it does, based on essentially the skills of everyone present. Which, I don't know, your family might be great or might be slim,
mm-hmm.
You know, and your skills, you know, relationally and politically and all of that. You know.
It's funny going through things like this in sort of the ability to sort of observe your association or disassociation with things like your own judgment of them and then, you know, sort of like recoiling that and naming that or whatever. Like, I got really sick on a plane when I first got pregnant, and I, for, like, 4 minutes, put a ring on my left finger because I was embarrassed.
Mm.
And then I was like, that's insane. That's insane. That's, like, a cultural pressure that I feel. And it actually has no bearing on my well-being right now. Or
in the moment, it had a tiny bearing. Like it allowed you to feel safer in a hostile environment.
Yeah.
On a very subtle level, perhaps, or not so
mm-hmm.
subtle. I think one of the things this teaching of respecting the past gives us is it actually lets us respect our choices in any moment. Right?
Yeah.
Your choice to do that was a perfectly sound self-protective choice based in real conditions. And then everything you do at home is the same thing, right? Whether you mention it over the turkey or not, your choice of what to do, or when you do something and you wish you had chosen otherwise but you couldn't help it, see if you can go, oh, look, that's what I needed to do. That was protective. That's what had to happen.
Mm-hmm.
So, good luck at home. And blessings.
Thank
blessings
you.
For baby. It's good. I'm excited to meet the little person. Very nice.
You too.
Very nice. Of course you are. They're the best. They're so good. Little pumpkins. Oh my God.
Already haven't talked about language.
Exactly. Exactly. It's one of the hugest things, right? When my little guy starts using words, and he has a lot of sign language also now, but he's expressing stuff, and I'm like, oh, you're not just a little bundle of appetites. You have will and ideas.
Expression.
You know, you sort of wander into the room, and you're like, I want this. And I'm like, okay, how did that happen? So yeah, an amazing language trip. All right. It's our time to close. Thank you so much, everyone, for being here. Opening into this realm of things. It's a pleasure, as always. We'll resume our series on the Paramis sometime very soon, next week, whenever, something like that. At the moment, I can't remember when we put our plane tickets. I might miss one of the Tuesdays over the holidays. It might be the one before Christmas.
That's next week.
Time. Jeez, people. All right. If that's the case, I'll send out a little note on my mailing list. But don't worry about it. There will be a sub anyway, and I'll be here the Tuesday following Christmas, and we can do, you know, debriefing, you know, from how it went. So blessings. Happy new full moon. Happy big full moon tonight. And if you're the type to pray, you could include the Electoral College in your prayers. Right. Thank you so much. As always, we're fully on donation in the beautiful practice of gift economy. Your gifts support others to come and support us to keep offering practice in this way. Thanks for your generosity. Donations go in the basket over there. See you soon.